It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
As you know, we are a program that does not shy away from controversial Bible passages, and one of the most controversial of all regarding Jesus and his life is his clearing of the temple, found in all four of the Gospels. Let me read to you from the Matthew account. Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. "It is written," he said to them, "my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers." Now, like I said, it's only one of the accounts. Elsewhere, we see that he actually got a whip and he was using it on people. So was Jesus violent? That's one of the questions people come up with. Another one is the fact that I mentioned it's in four of the Gospels. In John, it's very early in his ministry. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's much later in his ministry. It's after his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and very shortly before he was crucified. It may have even led to his crucifixion. Because you got to remember, in those days, there was nothing more important or sacred to the Jews than their temple. This was their second temple. The first one had been built under Solomon. It was destroyed by the Babylonians. God sent them prophet after prophet, warning that the temple would be destroyed because they had disobeyed him. They were involved in idol worship. Well, they weren't involved in idol worship these days, at least not the blatant kind where they were calling Dagon or Baal or some other idol from ancient Canaan God, but in the sense that they were claiming to worship the true God, but were being hypocritical and were reinventing in their minds what this God really stood for. Well, that too was a kind of corruption. And as you know, in 70 AD, several decades after the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, this temple was destroyed by Prince Titus and the Roman Legion. So this temple's on borrowed time too, but in these days, that's not the way the ancient Jews were looking at it. This temple had been restored when the Persians conquered Babylon, allowed the Jews to return from Babylon and rebuild their temple. It was rebuilt under the time of Ezra. King Herod had come along and beautified it. Yes, that villainous King Herod that tried to have all the children killed in his quest to find baby Jesus. But he was very popular for a while because he did beautify their temple. So it was a huge, beautiful temple. Some of the walls are still standing to this day, but that temple has been destroyed, as I said. And it was quite a thing during the Passover. Jews came from all over the world. It was kind of like the trip to Mecca of its day. And many of these Jews were foreigners who didn't speak Hebrew. And then, of course, by this time in history, Judaism and the love of Judaism had been spread all over the Grecian world. So there were a lot of Gentiles who didn't completely understand and hadn't completely become Jewish, but they were worshiping the same God. So there were Gentiles coming out as well. So that's what's going on. And John places this in his second chapter, much earlier in Jesus' ministry. This leads scholars to the questions, well, did he go and clear the temple twice? Or was John mistaken by putting it so early? Why was John the only one that put it early? Well, let's unpack this a little bit. Certainly, he could have cleared the temple twice. I consider it unlikely, though, because that was like the final blow, the final nail in the coffin. The religious rulers did not like Jesus. The priesthood was corrupt, as I said. The rabbis in those days had also become corrupt. They had this series of oral interpretations of Moses' law. They were claiming that when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, God not only gave him the written law, but orally an interpretation of the law that had been handed down generation after generation. There's really no record of this belief until the time of the Babylonian exile, but they sure believed it in Jesus' day, and to this day, Orthodox Jews still believe that. They believe that the Talmud will interpret the Bible for you, most specifically the first five books of the Bible, what they call the Torah. And they were adding rules and regulations that Moses had never really given them. Well, Jesus is coming along challenging these rules and regulations, calling them hypocrites. Can you imagine Jesus coming to our churches today and having more of a problem with the clergy and the pastors than everybody else and saying to the people, yeah, listen to what they say, but don't follow what they do? Or perhaps adding, not everything they're teaching you is really in the Bible. Well, the clergy would not like that. And they didn't like it when Jesus did it. So for the longest time, they were wondering whether they should execute him as a false prophet. Now, if he wasn't challenging them so much, perhaps they would have believed his claims to be the Jewish Messiah. They might have said, boy, this guy makes sense. And look at all the miracles he's doing. But because he challenged them for political, personal, selfish, prideful reasons, they had to find something wrong with him. Even when he did miracles, they claimed it was done by the power of Satan. It was sorcery. But in a way, by Jesus clearing the temple, he was making things easy for them. So again, all to say, it is certainly possible that Jesus did this twice early in his ministry, which would be suggested by John, and then again later in his ministry. But I don't think we have to be threatened by the fact that John has it out of order. For one thing, there's precedent for this. For example, in John 8, the very famous passage where Jesus rescues the woman caught in adultery. As you know, what we have today in our New Testament are copies of the manuscripts. We don't have the originals. That's not really a problem. That's true for all ancient history. But in the copies of John's Gospels, this passage about the woman in adultery is found in different places. In fact, it's nicknamed by scholars the floating passage. So there's precedent for the fact that John at times had things out of order. That doesn't give any kind of threat whatsoever to the notion that this is the Word of God. What's inspired are the words, not the chronology. And we don't have John saying, oh, he actually came out and he cleared the temple twice. Look, here's an earlier time. So I think it happened one time, but I wanted to check that one off of our list first. That's the first question people raise. Is this a contradiction because John has it earlier? No, I don't consider that a contradiction at all. The next concern is the violence. When we think of Jesus, we think of a very peaceful person. That was true as a general rule. The purpose of his first coming was to announce forgiveness and proclaim the gospel. But he made it very clear that there was going to be a second coming. And to say that the second coming would be violent is the understatement of the century. The second coming of Jesus will come as a warrior. He will deliver the nation of Israel from her enemies. He will rule from Jerusalem over the whole world. Doesn't mean it'll be a Jewish kingdom. It's just that Israel is associated with this prophecy. He is coming, and he's coming as a warrior, and that is no contradiction to the major theme of the Bible over the years. When you read the Old Testament, it's one war after another. Pacifism is not taught in the Bible, and it was never taught by Jesus. You can make the case that Jesus' first coming was not a military coming, but that did not mean that Jesus was teaching that there would never be a time when self-defense or righteous indignation or righteous judgment was not needed. With God, it's never one size fits all. And there is such a thing in the Bible as righteous anger. A lot of people say, well, anger is a sin. Well, uncontrolled anger is a sin. Anger born out of bitterness is a sin. Inappropriate anger is a sin. Anger with an evil motive is a sin. But this is righteous anger. Jesus is seeing a lot of hypocrisy. Now, some would say, well, wait a minute, Bob. You say it's not one size fits all. You say that Jesus didn't really have a problem with violence, but there was a place where he taught against violence. In fact, he taught pacifism. Back in Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, from his very first sermon, he said, if somebody strikes you on the cheek, turn to him the other cheek. Well, that's true. He said that. And there are whole Christian denominations, the Quakers, the Amish, the Mennonite Brethren, who take that literally. They would say Christians should be pacifists. They should not involve themselves in any kind of violence at all. There's some Christians that say we should never go to war or be soldiers. Some have problems even becoming policemen. You need to understand the culture of Jesus' day. Because much as I admire those denominations, I really do like them. I like the stands they take. I admire them. I admire their perseverance. I admire their faithfulness. There is a misunderstanding of what Jesus is saying. In those days, amongst the rabbis, striking somebody on the cheek was a way of insulting them. Striking them back was returning insult for insult. What Jesus seems to be saying here is do not return insult for insult. He's not saying if somebody strikes you on the cheek, you have to just stand there and let them beat the snot out of you. That's not what he's saying. So I know that in one of the accounts, he picks up a whip and he hits the people with it. And some try to get around that and say, well, maybe he didn't hit the people. Maybe he hit the animals. I don't think we have to go to that conclusion. It is true that this violence was not common in Jesus' first coming, but it was not representing a hypocrisy in Jesus' first coming either. And again, in the second coming, he is coming as a warrior anyway. So there really isn't a problem with the violence. That is not a contradiction to the teachings of Jesus. Now that leads the idea of his motive, of his not liking seeing business go on. This has also birthed a lot of misunderstanding, and I must say much of it was my own. And it was prevalent amongst my brothers and sisters. I was saved in college. I started going to church as a college student. I attended a very large and popular church in San Jose, California. They had guest speakers from all over the world, very famous Christian speakers. And a lot of times I would hear them say, if you enjoyed the message, Mac's books and tapes are on sale in our lobby. And that really bugged me and that really bugged my friends, the idea of selling something at church. And we thought, boy, if Jesus was here, he'd go out there and overturn these book tables. And of course, they don't use tapes anymore. Today, they'd say CDs or MP3 downloads more likely. But back then, it was his books are available, his tapes are available. We still see the books all the time today. And I thought that was just a sin until I realized what was going on. Let me describe the situation in these days. The outer court of the Gentiles, a place actually called the court of the Gentiles at the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, that is where sacrificial animals might be purchased. There were tables where foreign coinage could be exchanged for Jewish money. And with this exchange, there was a small, modest fee, modest, I say in quotes. Also, there were temple inspectors, very much like today's smog test. Your car has to get smogged. You take it to a mechanic who fails the smog test, but by an incredible coincidence, since he is a mechanic, he could do the work for you, and then it will pass. Of course, you have to pay him to do the work. That's what was going on with the temple inspections. Hey, there's a blemish on this animal. Now, it's true that if you look at the Old Testament law, animals without blemish were the ones that were supposed to be brought before God. This typified the sacrifice that Jesus would eventually do. Nobody understood this at the time. So it's true that they wanted them without blemish, but this idea of an inspector, and he's the professional, and he's the expert, and he's going to tell you whether your animal has a blemish or not, and if it does have a blemish, just by an incredible coincidence, this is your lucky day, we have an unblemished animal we can sell you. This is what Jesus was objecting to. Had it simply been that somebody came to the temple and they wanted to sacrifice something, and they did not come from a farm, and they had no animal, and they sold them an animal, that would have been fine, and it's fine when people sell their books today. Now, it still leaves that sting in my mouth that people sell anything in church at all. As you know, I am an author. I've done a lot of speaking in churches. I have had books available. What we've always done was offered them for free. We have been willing to take a donation if people wanted to give them. We don't actually charge when I do it, but that's me. I'm not telling other people what to do. The point is, this is not what was going on. Jesus did not have a problem with the fact that they were selling animals at the temple. He had a problem with the fact that they were cheating people in the way they sold the animals, deliberately failing their animals, like the guy that deliberately fails you on your smog test. Anyway, just a few clarifications about a very controversial passage in the Bible. This is Bob Siegel, hopefully making the obvious obvious.
I'm Dr. David Poole, president of San Diego Christian College. At SDCC, you'll find a number of dynamic degree and certificate programs, including business, aviation, kinesiology, education, psychology, ministry, and more. Our curriculum blends academic excellence with a Christian worldview, ensuring you graduate ready to make a meaningful impact. Your journey starts here. Learn more at sdcc.edu. That's sdcc.edu. San Diego Christian College. Begin your journey.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Looking for a church that will not only challenge you but help you to feel like a part of a family? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego near 94 in Hamishaw? I can testify firsthand to Skyline because I myself am a member. When you visit, tell them Bob Siegel sent you and ask about that free week-long trip to Bermuda for first-time visitors. They'll look at you like they don't know what you're talking about, and you will not, in fact, get any free trip to Bermuda, but you'll still be glad for a chance to experience Skyline Church. You don't want to go to Bermuda anyway. Too hot. And people who approach that area have been known to disappear. But they don't disappear at Skyline. Those who visit usually can't wait to come back.
Skyline Church.
An interesting Bible question, one that you don't hear quite as often, but it's a fascinating discussion. In the book of Hebrews, the author is trying to talk people out of returning to the old covenant. Hebrews was written to a church made up mostly of Jewish Christians. They thought they had seriously made a mistake giving their lives to Christ. And so he's going through some of the very popular Jewish beliefs and understandings and showing how Jesus fulfilled them. For example, in the Old Testament, we often talk about the fact that they made animal sacrifices. The author of Hebrews makes the point that Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice, but he also talks about Jesus as the ultimate high priest. He was God. He came down in the form of a man, and as God-man, he's in a perfect position to be a mediator between God and human beings. The high priesthood goes back to the time of Aaron. It had to be a descendant of Aaron. In fact, originally through Aaron's children, his firstborn Eleazar. The high priest, once a year on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, went into the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant was and sprinkled blood and had made a sacrifice on behalf of the people. Well, the author of Hebrews is trying to say that Jesus is not only the sacrifice, he's also the high priest. This is a form of prophecy known to the ancient Hebrew culture as typology. The book of Hebrews is full of typology. You see a lot in the book of Matthew as well, and a few of them in other places. But in making his airtight case, and the author of Hebrews, we don't actually know who it was, but he seemed like somebody who would have made a great attorney, because it's a very legal argument. He's anticipating the argument that Jesus couldn't possibly be the high priest because he's not of the tribe of Levi. That was Moses' tribe. That was Aaron's tribe. There are other predictions about the Messiah, and we do know that the Messiah who's eventually going to rule as king over Israel had to be a descendant of King David. Problem is, David's of the tribe of Judah. So how does somebody from the tribe of Judah become our next high priest when you had to be related to Aaron and the tribe of Levi to be high priest? Well, what the author of Hebrews does is he leapfrogs back through time and says, long before the time of Aaron, there was another priest, a priest named Melchizedek, and this priest blessed Abraham. Now, Melchizedek is only mentioned briefly in the book of Genesis. Then he's mentioned again in one of the Psalms, but the author of Hebrews talks about him more than anybody else, develops the case better, and gives us more clues as to who Melchizedek Dick is. Although, frankly, the clues are shrouded in a lot of mystery. You'll see what I mean in a moment. First, let me read from Genesis and some of these other passages of Scripture. I'm reading from Genesis 14, 18 through 20. Back then, Abraham was known by the name Abram. Abram means exalted father. It was common when people changed their character or rededicated themselves to God to have a name change. Abram, of course, was changed to Abraham, which means father of a multitude. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. The word Salem is an English form of the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace, and the city of Salem was actually the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem in Hebrew, city of peace. And what does the name Melchizedek mean? Well, that came from a Canaanite term. It means my king, the God. Well, that's all we hear about Melchizedek, just briefly here in the book of Genesis. Then later in the Psalms, he comes up again. It's a messianic psalm where the Lord says to the Messiah, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." Okay, so those are two brief passages. Now, when we get to the book of Hebrews, there's a lot of elaboration. It's in Hebrews 5, 6 through 10, where the author starts by quoting that very psalm that I just read to you. Then it continues in Hebrews 6, 19 through 20. Then Hebrews 7, 1 through 22. Huge chunk of scripture. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you word for word because you're listening to a radio show. You didn't subscribe to the Bible online. Not that that's a bad thing to do. And I certainly encourage you on your own time to read and study this for yourself. But let me give you the gist of what the guy is saying. He's saying, okay, Jesus was not related to Aaron, but that doesn't disqualify him as being high priest because Abraham, the father of our nation, in fact, that makes him the father of Moses, the father of Aaron, or I guess great-great-grandfather, you could say. Levi was actually in Abraham's loins when Abraham was blessed by this other priest called Melchizedek. So in a manner of speaking, Aaron was blessed by Melchizedek. Melchizedek is a prior priest, and Jesus is a priest in this order, and with Melchizedek, the lineage doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, speaking of Melchizedek's lineage, the author of Hebrews writes, "Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever." With that language, it sounds like this is another pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament. And we've talked about those pre-incarnate appearances before, how he appeared in the form of a man to Abraham, how he appeared in the form of a man to Jacob, how he appeared in the form of a man to Joshua. We've talked about that. Is this another one? Is this another pre-incarnate appearance? Well, at first we're going to say very possible because we have biblical precedent for that. We see it in other places. However, there is another viewpoint that some theologians make, and they're just making the case that the Jews used to speak with a lot of exaggerated hyperbole, and when they say without beginning of days or end of life, they simply mean that we don't know his genealogy, and therefore it's okay for Jesus to be descended from him, where the genealogy doesn't matter since they're making such a big deal out of the genealogy of Aaron in this church that the author of Hebrews is writing to. That is certainly possible. That is certainly a viewpoint to consider. However, in this lengthy discourse, the writer of Hebrews then says something else. And here are the words. In Hebrews chapter 7, verse 8, he compares the regular high priests to Melchizedek. And he says, in one case, the tenth is collected by men who die, but in the other case, by him who is declared to be living. What interesting words, declared to be living. Now, this is written some 2,000 years after the time of Abraham, and yet Melchizedek is still declared to be living. As far as I'm concerned, even though I respect the other viewpoint, Melchizedek clearly was another example of Jesus in the Old Testament, the Son of God, God the Word, God the Messenger, a pre-incarnate appearance. And so Jesus is a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. And who was Melchizedek? Jesus. Jesus is his own priesthood. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone,